Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
And now, coming up, National Book Award winner Tim Egan and his incredible story of Dust Bowl America. But first, after a secret ballot this morning, Congressman Steny Hoyer won over enough Democrats to become the next majority leader in the House and the right-hand man to the new Speaker, Nancy Pelosi. But he's not the man Nancy Pelosi wanted. Hoyer, a longtime rival, she passed over him even though he was in line for the post. Pundits say that spells trouble for Speaker Pelosi and Democrats only a week after they won both houses of Congress. Well, joining us on the line from Capitol Hill is Chuck Babington, congressional correspondent for The Washington Post. And I know, Chuck, this is relatively new, but tell us, what does this mean that Steny Hoyer beat out Nancy Pelosi's choice, John Murtha from Pennsylvania?
It means that Speaker-to-be Pelosi has gotten off to quite a stumble before she even takes the office of Speaker. I think it's going to be widely seen as a miscalculation on her part. I think she's going to have some explaining to do, both privately to associates and more publicly to the public at large, about why she did pick this fight. A lot of people were scratching their heads, Robin, about why she would do this when it wasn't really necessary. You know, you did mention that, in a sense, she and Steny Hoyer are rivals, but in truth, that rivalry was settled 4 years ago when she defeated Hoyer rather easily for the leadership of the party, and I don't think anybody really believed that Hoyer would ever try to challenge her again. So it's a rather perplexing that she took the route that she did.
Well, let's just remind people who John Murtha is and why she might have taken that route. He's the gruff former Marine, early hawk on the war in Iraq, but one of the first hawks to turn and to really become a vocal and a much applauded by many Democrats critic of the Iraq War. So was she, you know, perhaps, you know, attempting to reward him for that? Because as the midterm elections show, many Americans now agree with him.
I think, Robin, it's less that. Yes, to the degree that Jack Murtha of Pennsylvania is known at all to the outside world, to anybody outside of his district, it is because of he did make a big splash last fall when he called for the beginning of withdrawing troops from Iraq. That was actually a seminal moment, and it did endear him to many liberals and anti-war activists. And he's not liberal in many other ways at all. But I think, you know, that's what we tend to focus on when we think about Murtha, but that's not the main thing that was at play here. It really goes back. These inside leadership type of positions really are based largely on longtime friendships. He was Pelosi's campaign manager back 4 years ago when she defeated Steny Hoyer for the party leadership position. And so this is really a long-time, long-standing friendship. And, it, you know, when you looked at who sort of backed who, you really can't make any ideological sense of it, because you have some liberals with Hoyer, some liberals with Murtha, and vice versa, with, you know, the same thing with conservatives. And it really is more of these elections are more like almost like high school class president elections, you know, who was friends with who helped me out with a situation a few years ago and that sort of thing.
Well, but what really does it mean now that Steny Hoyer is the majority leader? What really, how much power is in that role?
Not a great deal of power in the big scheme of things. Certainly the Speaker is a constitutional officer and is by far and away the most powerful member of the House. The majority leader, you know, certainly is will have a lot to do with how the Democratic caucus sets its priorities and that sort of thing, but he can always be overruled by the Speaker, by Pelosi. I think the real meaning is that it raises a big question. I mean, already there was a question in people's minds that the Democrats are back in control of the House after 12 years in the minority. What will they do? How will they set their priorities? What type of tone will they set? And this is a tone that really has baffled a lot of people. Not only does it seem to, you know, it seems to weaken Pelosi's position, but because she could not even come close to getting her choice elected for the number two slot, but also it raises questions about her concerns about, you know, ethics, because, you know, Murtha did have, he was somewhat tainted by abscam, even though he was not indicted.
Never indicted, yeah.
Exactly.
But check in just a few seconds we have, will this is this something they can move on from and quickly become something in the rearview mirror?
They can, yes, and I think they will. In the big scheme of things, this will not be a big deal, you know, 5 or 6 months from now, and certainly not to the general public. But within the world, the little world of Democrats in the House, this will definitely be remembered and something that they'll talk about for a long time.
Chuck Babington, congressional correspondent for The Washington Post, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, today, a break from politics and war to spend a few minutes acknowledging the just-announced National Book Award winners, books that stood out from a field of nominees, many of them about politics and war. The Echo Maker, Richard Powers' story of memory loss in the wake of 9/11 and the Iraq War, won for Best Fiction. And The Astonishing Life of Octavian Nothing, won for Young People's Literature. Now, you might remember we spoke with Cambridge, Massachusetts author M.T. Anderson recently about his compelling mystical tale of a young black in pre-revolutionary America who thinks he's a prince and discovers he's a slave. Well, we reached Tobin Anderson this morning at the Algonquin Hotel in New York where he was staying after last night's awards. The excitement still had not worn off.
I kept on thinking, my gosh, if I could tell my 15-year-old self that I would be walking into the dining room of the Algonquin with the National Book Award under my arm, you know, a few decades later, it would have actually made my head explode. It would have been just so exciting. It was like a dream.
Author M.T. Anderson. Well, in January, we spoke with another then-future winner, Tim Egan's book, The Worst Hard Time, The Untold Story of Those Who Survived the Great American Dust Bowl, won the National Book Award for Nonfiction, beating out other books such as Lawrence Wright's The Looming Tower. In his acceptance speech last night, Egan said he hopes his book will serve as a bridge back to this period of American history once those who lived through it are gone. Well, his book does just that.
The windows of houses were covered with wet sheets and blankets, the doors taped, the wall cracks stuffed with rags and newspapers. Men avoided shaking hands with each other because the static electricity was so great it could knock another person down. Car owners used chains, dragging them along the street as a ground for the electricity in the air. Hospitals postponed operations because they could not keep their surgical wards clean. And flour mills in Kansas had to curtail work because the dust mingled with grain.
Author and National Book Award winner Tim Egan. Well, we'd like to reprise that conversation today. When we spoke, I asked Tim Egan to describe the Great Plains before the Dust Bowl. Now, it was roughly the size of Pennsylvania, stretching from the panhandles of Texas and Oklahoma, covering parts of New Mexico and Colorado. It was once a fertile, abundant grassland. He said folks back then thought it was Eden.
Walt Whitman called it that ever-recurring miracle, the grasslands. And, you know, it was an ocean of grass. It just stretched forever. Mm. And even in dry years, it was a pretty good place because there was always some forage for animals. And so it had the 20 million members of the southern bison herd. And that's why people first started to come there as well.
But the bison were cleared out.
Yeah. In less than a generation's time, probably 15 years, the bison were cleared out. The Indians who still lived there and thought that they had that land, it's south of the Arkansas River, north of the Red River, they thought that land was theirs by treaty. The treaty was broken. They were moved to outside of Lawton, Oklahoma. So interestingly, at the start of the 20th century, you had this huge hole in the United States, and the census measured exactly zero people in the Texas Panhandle, which was a big part of the Dust Bowl. Zero.
And it became a part of this great land grab, everyone from the government to real estate speculators encouraging people to go to this land and turn the grassland under, plow it under.
They came because they could own something, and that was a really big deal. The slogan was, every man a landlord. And over the course of about 20 years, at the early start of the 20th century, we had all these towns just rose, and people went overnight from living in sod houses, living in dugouts, to making a fairly decent living on this land.
Because they were selling wheat. They had turned over all the grassland. As you say, they were sod busters. They'd busted the sod, planted the wheat, and people needed the wheat.
And not only that, the rains came. So it was a green period down there. And, you know, they made the mistake that we always make, that humans have always made, is which when things are going good, do you think they'll go this way all the time? It did work for a while.
But then at a certain point, the demand for the wheat dropped off. And a drought came, the rain stopped. But before that, people, as you said, did come because it was a jewel of a place. You met people who either knew these people or you met people directly who were still, you know, still living in this land. Tell us about one of them, Hazel Shaw.
She came with this big clan from the South, and they moved up. It was the everyman a landlord syndrome. They got a little piece of Oklahoma dirt. They're coming up by horse-drawn wagon into Oklahoma territory. It was a hard place to love, a tableau for mischief and sudden death from the sky or up from the ground. Hazel Lucas, a daring little girl with straw-colored hair, first saw the grasslands near the end of a family journey to claim a homestead. She got up on the tips of her toes in the horse-drawn wagon to stare into an abyss of beige. It was as empty as the back end of a day, a wilderness of flat. The family then clawed a hole in the side of the prairie just south of Boy City. It was not the promised land Hazel had imagined, but it had possibility.
Tim Egan reading from his book about the Dust Bowl. But even then, it was such a hardscrabble life. I mean, you write about people living in these dugout holes with, you know, bugs in the walls and tough life.
One of the families I profiled, the mother would iron the walls as a way to kill bugs who were always crawling around between there. But then people built plank houses during the good years, and they thought, you know, it's we're on our way. We have something. Mm-hmm. And, of course, what broke that was the start of the 1930s.
The 1930s, which saw not only the Great Depression nationwide, but, as we said, no more demand for the wheat that the people had planted and the drought. What happened to the land because it had been overturned and used for wheat?
This was a drought that started in 1931, and it was a bad one. It lasted a long time. It was probably the worst of the century. But the plains has always had droughts. What was different now, Robin, was that the grass was gone. Without anything to hold the ground down, though, without any grass, when the drought came, it didn't even get the wheat up in the spring. The land was fallow. And as the wind blew and as the soil calcified, this dirt took to the sky in great mountainous swoops.
Just unbelievable scenes that you paint of people breathing it in, trying to drive through it.
Everyone would put Vaseline in their nostrils as a filter. They had the Red Cross distributed these masks that people all wore before they went outside. Of course, they'd quickly get dirty. They taped their windows down at night with bed sheets. They'd wet them down, I should say, that would become muddy in the morning. And people said time and again that when you woke up in the morning, the only thing in your house that was not covered with a fine layer of dust was the little outline of where your head had rested on the pillow at night before. People told me when they cooked, they would only turn the pots up just before you cooked, and then you'd turn it back down again. You'd milk a cow in the water, and the milk would be somewhat muddied. Their animals would go blind because dust would get in their eyes. You'd do an autopsy to find their stomachs were all bound up with it. Children would die of this horrible thing the doctors called dust pneumonia. And it was basically their young lungs were just filled up with dirt, as one of the doctors said.
Given this, Tim Egan, you write about the people who stayed. Why did they stay?
The reason they stayed was twofold. One is they had something, and that meant something. They had a piece of dirt, and they thought, this can't go on forever. And they were afraid of the city. They'd go to the movies in their little town and see these newsreels of people waiting in line to get soup and people selling apples for 5 cents a pop and stories of suicides on Wall Street. And they were really afraid of the city. They thought, at least in the country we have something. We can raise a pig and slaughter it, or we can grow something. And the second thing was they thought it had to get better. They were called tomorrow people. You know, when you're in the middle of something like this, you don't know you're in the middle of an epic siege. You think it's temporary. You think it has to end, but it lasted most of 10 years.
Author Tim Egan, he's just won the National Book Award for Nonfiction for The Worst Hard Time. When we come back, the Dust Bowl's worst day, Black Sunday. And on the other side of that, the move today to close homeless shelters. Backers say there's a better way. Stay with us here and now. And now our conversation continues now with Tim Egan. His book, The Worst Hard Time, The Untold Story of Those Who Survived the Great American Dust Bowl, just won the National Book Award for Nonfiction. We spoke with him earlier this year. There's one particular day that changed the Dust Bowl and changed America. It was April 14th, 1935. It became known as Black Sunday because on that day, the worst dust storm of all time hit, carrying more than 300 tons of dirt. Well, I asked him to read us a passage that describes what it was like that day.
My God, here it comes. Dodge City went black. The front edge of the duster looked 2,000 feet high. Winds were clocked at 65 miles an hour. A few minutes earlier, there had been bright sunshine and a temperature of 81 degrees, without a wisp of wind. Drivers turned on their headlights now but could not see ahead of them or even see the person sitting next to them. It was like three midnights in a jug, one old Nestor said. Cars died, their systems shorted out by the static. People fled to tornado shelters, fire stations, gyms, church basements. There was a whiff of panic, not evident in earlier storms, as a fear took hold that the end was near. A woman in Kansas said she thought of killing her child to spare the baby the cruelty of Armageddon.
And this storm, this Black Sunday storm, also went up and down the coast. It approached Washington. It reminds us this Dust Bowl occurred because of a land rush, people in the government included, encouraging people to rush and take land in this area and rip out the grass and plant wheat. But there were detractors of that. One of them is a soil scientist named Hugh Bennett, and he's making a presentation to the Senate trying to make the case for a massive soil conservation project when the big storm comes by.
Yeah, this is a fascinating convergence of policy and natural disaster, or human man-caused disaster, I should say. Bennett, who was a scholar, but also, you know, a man of the people, sort of commoner, who's really had a good gift of gab and knew how to tell a story, was speaking to the Senate a few days after Black Sunday, and he'd heard that the residue of the storm was making its way east. And as he spoke, he tried to sort of filibuster and drag it out, and aide came and whispered in his ear and said, "It's almost here. Keep going." So he, you know, palavered for a while and kept talking, and then a half hour went by and they said, keep going, it's almost here. At last, it's about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, they looked outside and the sky did darken, and Bennett rose, told everyone to look outside and said, "There it is, that's what I've been talking about. There goes Oklahoma." And the Senate approved that day of the measure to create the Soil Conservation Service. FDR signed it the next day, and to this day, the Soil Conservation Service is the only New Deal grassroots organization left over from the 1930s, the only grassroots organization left. And people think it was largely responsible for why the land didn't take off in later droughts.
I'm wondering, you know, we started by saying that you met some of the people who were some of the survivors. I'm thinking of Ike Osteen. Is he the one who came out when you went up to him and he said, "You're here to talk about the drought"? How do they say it?
They all call it the drought. Yeah, it's just an aberration of a dialect.
Just the way they say it. But I'm wondering, of those who are survivors or their children, do they blame themselves?
That's a great question. They have a real mixed view. They didn't need the pioneering ecologists of the New Deal to come out. They didn't need Hugh Bennett to come out and tell them, as Hugh Bennett said at one speech, that they had committed suicide on the land. A lot of them knew what they were doing was pushing it. And it's, you know, it was simple hubris. The price was so good.
Well, and I was going to say, and the government was encouraging them. In fact, there were subsidies to some of these farmers to keep growing the wheat that nobody would buy.
Yeah, they gave them extraordinary incentives to get out there. I mean, the railroads were all taking them out there for free. The government, as I said earlier, had enlarged the Homestead Act, deliberately trying to populate this part. And they sent out these edicts, plant more wheat, plant as much as you can. We'll sell it as soon as you can get it up and get it to market. But one of the ironies is at a time when 25% of Americans were out of work and when people were literally starving. I mean, they sent a telegram from Boy City, Oklahoma, to the Congress saying, "In desperate need of help, 80% of us in semi-starvation right now." Mm. At a time when that was going on, wheat was rotting by the side of the railroad tracks because there wasn't any market for it, and you could only do so much with it.
So, Tim Egan, what is another lesson of the Dust Bowl?
Well, I think it's an ancient lesson. I really do. I think it goes back to the Greeks, and it goes back to things our parents and grandparents told us, which is you know, if you push nature too hard, it will push back. It has a breaking point. And we like to think we learned this, but then you see disasters happen over and over again. And this was a classic tale of hubris. They pushed too hard, and then the natural world broke down.
Mm. Tim Egan, correspondent with the New York Times, his book about the American Dust Bowl is called The Worst Hard Time, The Untold Story of Those Who Survived the Great American Dust Bowl, which, as we said, Tim, happened, during the Depression. And I just happened to note in the foreword, you dedicated this to your dad, raised by his widowed mother during the darkest years of the Great Depression, 4 to a bedroom.
My father was, raised by a single mother in a little apartment in Chicago. He's Irish Catholic and never had any money. And it's a nice fulfillment of my dreams to be able to dedicate this book to him.
I mean, we've spoken of the lesson of the Dust Bowl. You note a lesson imparted from him.
He raised 7 kids when he raised us, my family. And we never saw him sweat, and I learned later he had some pretty hard times himself. But the interesting thing that comes out of this, you can't do a book on the Depression and not come away and feel how lucky we are with at least our material comforts. You think of a time when people lived with earthen floors, and they were eating canned and brined tumbleweed, and there was no Social Security, there was no safety net. They had no idea what tomorrow was going to bring them. They butchered their very last farm animal and ate, as they used to say, everything but the squeal after they butchered a hog.
You wrote of another scene where a young farmhand walks into a hospital and the doctor takes a look at him and says, "You're filled with dirt, you're going to die," and he dies.
And he died a few days later. He said, "Son, you're just filled up with dirt." So one of the lessons is I hope I won't complain anymore about any material discomfort.
Author Tim Egan speaking to us back in January about his book, The Worst Hard Time, The Untold Story of Those Who Survived the Great American Dust Bowl. It was honored last night with the National Book Award for Nonfiction. Now, we mentioned that Richard Powers won for Best Fiction for his story, The Echo Maker. And we want to also note that Nathaniel Mackey won the Poetry Award for Splay Anthem. Well, we're going to take a break and be back with a new look at the homeless. But another quick note, tomorrow on Here and Now, a Philadelphia mother remembers her late son who learned to forgive the people who shot him. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. More ahead Here and Now. Funding for Here and Now. And we're going to launch a series of conversations today about the homeless, looking at new ways of thinking about their problems. Today, a growing trend toward closing homeless shelters. Backers say shelters don't work, and the solution is simple: provide real housing. Here in Framingham, Massachusetts, a nonprofit group recently closed the Common Ground Shelter after 16 years and provided a different solution for the 29 people who live there. One of them is Charles Dawkins. Welcome.
Yes.
And when you heard that Common Ground was going to close, what did you think?
I was nervous. I was like, what am I going to do?
Yeah, and they have apparently provided housing for everyone. Can you describe where you moved to?
Yes, I moved to a woman house, which housed about, on an estimate, about maybe 30 guys and 30 females. The guys live upstairs, the females live downstairs.
So this is real housing. This isn't a shelter with cots. You have your own room?
Yep, I got my own room. I got my own bed. I got, TV. This is sober living.
Well, sober living. We understand that you were, wrestling with substance abuse. This is one of the things that kept putting you on the street.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. How long had you been in Common Ground, and how long had you been off and on the street?
I was off and on the streets. So for the last 6 years, I got involved with Common Ground coming out of detox, and I was there for about 30 days.
How does this feel now to you? We understand you do have to, pay a rent, but it's covered by your Medicare?
Right. Portion is covered through MassHealth, and then after a certain amount of time, I have to stop paying my own rent.
And how do you feel about that?
I like that. It's given me the opportunity to focus on getting involved in counseling.
Do you think you're going to be able to do it?
Yes.
I'm wondering, hearing that from you about you're looking forward to paying some of your rent, when you live in a shelter or you're on the street, does it make you feel less and less able to someday pay your own rent?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Here it's given me the opportunity to have some hope. It gives me opportunity to learn and get involved in independent living. I feel real good. I feel real good about myself. My self-esteem has raised a little bit more than what it was. It's given me hope.
Well, Charles Dawkins, obviously you are a voice that speaks very loudly in support of this new thinking. We wish you the best. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, a new University of Pennsylvania study shows that people like Charles who move from shelters to more long-term housing do tend to stay off the streets. Now, these programs are relatively new, but after 2 years, 80% of the people who moved out of shelters are still living in their new homes. Dr. Dennis Culhane headed that study. He joins us on the line from Philadelphia. Dr. Culhane, for some context, who makes up the homeless population now, and how long have these groups traditionally stayed in shelters?
Well, the population remains predominantly, about two-thirds of them are folks who are single adults, people who are not accompanied by children, and a third of them are families. families actually stay on average longer than the singles do, and I think the average stay is something about 5 months, but there are different groups, some that stay very short and some that stay very long. And among the singles population, it's about 3 months is the average length of time, but there is, of course, this 10% who stays for years at a time. What's been most noteworthy, I think, in the policy arena is that there's really been a whole developing enthusiasm around new housing strategies that seem to be working in getting people off the streets, reducing the size of the street homeless population, and also getting families out of the shelter system.
You know, why is this? Because one remembers when there weren't enough shelters and there was a hue and cry to have a safe place that the homeless could go immediately. So what's the thinking about starting with housing first?
People always do much better when they're in housing than they do when they're homeless. What happens to families when they become homeless is that it's very disruptive. First, for the kids, they have to end up commuting long distances in many cases to their schools. They have to change schools. They have, you know, absenteeism. So it has a huge toll on their educational process. But you also have, for the family, just all of the, you know, not just the pain and difficulty of what led to their becoming homeless, but then having to live in these large organizations that are not really designed as, to be homes for people, with strangers having to try to make do in a very cramped quarters. It's not a good situation for people to be in, and the sooner they get out, the better.
You can spiral further while in. But do you worry that there will be fewer places for people to go in emergency situations?
I do not. I mean, I know that there is some concern because in Framingham they've closed the shelter, and in some other parts of the state there have been some shelters that have closed. I think that's a good sign. That means we're winning the battle against homelessness. The fewer people who are in shelters, the better off we are as a society.
There's been a lot of concern that when shelters close, even if the intent is to move people into housing, there may not be safety nets, and you know, it's actually putting more people back on the street.
If we think that shelters are a safety net, then the net is laying on the ground because it doesn't feel very good when you fall onto it. So I think that the key is that, you know, shelters have never been intended as a really effective social welfare response, and our reliance on them has really not been very positive because of the, you know, the effects it has on children and the effects it has on people.
You're saying that shelters have sort of stood in the way of people thinking further what to do for the homeless.
Exactly. We have set the bar far too low if we think that shelter is the solution for our housing problems. We have lots of other things we can be doing much more creatively that aren't as costly and which are, quite frankly, more normalized residential and living environments for people than living in shelters.
What's the cost comparison, putting someone in housing versus a shelter?
Well, it's really quite striking. You know, when you look at families in shelter, for example, in Massachusetts, we recently completed a study which showed that the families who stay for a long-term basis it's about $50,000 for them to be in shelter for about a year and 2 months. And, you know, compare that with what would it cost to provide a housing voucher, probably only about, you know, $10,000 for the year. So I think there is also an economic argument to be made that, you know, shelters are very expensive and they help relatively few people. And if we could convert that to a cash assistance and vouchering program, it probably would serve more people better. And everyone would be better off.
Dr. Dennis Culhane, national expert on the homeless at the University of Pennsylvania, on the new trend to close the shelters and build more housing for the homeless. Dr. Culhane, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
So, what do you think? As we said, we're going to continue to look at some of the new approaches to the homeless across the country over the next few months. Some are very controversial. For instance, homeless panhandlers in Orlando, Florida, are being corralled in steel pens. They're called panhandling zones. We'd love to hear your thoughts about the homeless issue or anything on the program. Our email address, letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please include your full name, your phone number, and your town. Well, still to come, home, if you're lucky enough to have one, for the Thanksgiving holiday. You're listening to Here and Now. this weekend is a big one for college football fans, as the number one ranked Ohio State meets number two ranked University of Michigan in Ohio, with the winner becoming a likely favorite for the national title. So here to talk about that and the rest of the news in the world of sports, Only a Game host Bill Littlefield. Bill, welcome as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Michigan, Ohio State, aside from the college rankings, this is always a big game, right?
It's always a big game, and you can always count on the curious tradition made famous at Ohio State in Columbus, Ohio, which is pushing couches out into the road and setting them on fire.
Of course.
I don't know who the first one to do that was, but it certainly has caught on in Columbus.
When I'm a little excited, I always like to
push your couch out. Right. Set it on fire.
Is the winner automatic for the college title, or is there a dark horse waiting?
No, it's never automatic. That's why they play the games. And there's some dark horses lurking sort of down further in the standings. Boise State is still undefeated, which is kind of fun. But, of course, the usual suspects are also playing very well. Florida, USC, Notre Dame, teams like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, here in Boston, the sports pages are full of stories about the Red Sox latest move. Help me understand this. They put up a $51 million bid just to have the right to speak with Japanese pitcher Daisuke Matsuzaka.
Yes. What we're really talking about here is a preliminary to a move. Because if talks go well between this pitcher and the Red Sox, they will, in fact, have a new starter. And if talks don't go well, they'll get their $51 million back, and somebody else will pay some other number of millions of dollars to talk to him again.
But the $51 million is just to start the talks. If they do get him, they then have to also pay him?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. They still have to sign him to a contract. This is, I think, an example of player agents learning from teams, which some time ago introduced the concept of the seat license, where you pay a certain amount of money for the opportunity to buy a season ticket. So
amazing.
Teams have been sticking it to fans for years and years, and now agents are going to use the same implement to stick it to teams.
By the way, is he that good?
Well, he was certainly very good in the World Baseball Classic. Japan won it, and he won three games. So he looked good enough in that context
For
people to rate him very, very highly.
$51 million just to talk. Well, let's see. We do want to mention, last weekend's Major League Soccer final, your beloved Revolution fell to the Houston Dynamo in penalty kicks.
Yes, they did.
I'm so sorry.
So was I. In fact, there was much lamenting and renting of clothing around my house.
They have been compared, the Revolution, to the Buffalo Bills of the early 90s, never able to win the Super Bowl. Do you think it's just not, New England's fate to make it to the finals?
No, of course not. I don't think fate has anything to do with
it.
They played very well. In fact, they outplayed Houston, especially in the second half of that game. They had a terrible lapse right at the end of the game, 71 seconds after scoring the goal that should have won the game for them. But to suggest that it's their fate, no, I think that's silly. Steve Nichol has built a wonderful team, and I think they've played brilliantly, been very entertaining. They just didn't get it done that day.
Well, we have something for you to listen to that will certainly put a smile on your face. This is last night's finals of the ABC program Dancing with the Stars. Why are we asking you to listen to this? Well, just listen.
We will now reveal the winners and new champions of Dancing with the Stars. Emmett and Cheryl!
Emmett, as in former Dallas football great Emmett Smith, he and Cheryl Burke sambaed off with the Mirror Ball Trophy. Mm. Any comment on his moves?
Well, I'm curious, Robin. I have to admit that I wasn't paying attention to this earth-shaking event. So I know Emmett Smith played for the Dallas Cowboys, and he was a very successful player for years with them. He invented the Emmett Zone. I don't know who Cheryl is. So is Emmett the star, or was Cheryl the star?
Cheryl is, as they partner them with professional dancers.
Ah,
Cheryl's
she was
the dancer.
She was the dancer.
But let me tell you something. Emmett is a big man, and he can make some moves.
I don't doubt it, and he used to dance into the end zone quite successfully.
He's going to get a lot of real men going off to, Arthur Murray dance schools. It was just terrific. Only a Game host, Bill Littlefield, covering all sorts of news from the world of sports. Be sure to listen to Bill's program this weekend, and Bill, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
And you're listening to the music that Emmett danced to that wowed the judges, Stevie Wonder's Sir Duke. I think a lot of football fans will be dancing to this weekend. Stay with us. More ahead here now. here and now. Consider this as you prepare to sit around the holiday table next week. The day after, there's a chance no one is going to remember that meal in the same way. That idea is at the center of author Suzanne Burney's new book, A Ghost at the Table. It tells of sisters Frances and Cinny, each carrying their own versions of Thanksgiving's past. Other ghosts or near ghosts at their Thanksgiving table, a beloved sister who died too young, a mother possibly poisoned years ago, a once mighty father crippled by a stroke, and a strange parallel with the daughters of Mark Twain. Suzanne Burney is here to help us unravel it all. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me come in.
I wish I'd come up with this, but it's been said it's kind of a Chekhovian family you've set up because there are these three sisters. One now has died, a mother always sickly. You write, the kids learned not to require her. An older sister, somewhat depressed, but living in the beautiful Boston suburb of Concord. You're from this area as well, right?
I grew up in Virginia and Washington, D.C., but I've lived here for about 18 years.
Because it occurred to me that one of the ghosts at the table is Concord. You know, there's just this wonderful feeling around Thanksgiving here in New England.
Right. Well, and Concord is full of literary ghosts, too, which was another reason why I thought it would be a good setting for this novel.
And there are literary ghosts that parallel the story that you tell. Cinny is writing about the daughters of Mark Twain. Is this true, the stories of Mark Twain's daughters?
Yes. Yes, there was a granddaughter who committed suicide. The youngest daughter, Jean, was epileptic, died on Christmas Eve.
In a seizure in the bathtub.
In a seizure in the bathtub, yes.
Then there was Clara, who was depressed, and Susie considered somewhat neurotic.
Yes.
So Cinny is writing this real-life story, well, living out her own story, but her sister, Frances, who lives in this beautiful house in the suburbs with her family, sees not only her own family and Cinny's family differently than Cinny does, but sees Mark Twain's daughters differently.
Well, I think they're each invested in a story of history that they can identify with and that they can also see as promoting who they think they are and what they think their own stories are about. And Cinny is interested in finding out the dark parts of people's lives, the places where they were lonely or strange or left out. And Frances is very much interested in cleaning things up and presenting what she sees as a reasonable view of things, which is if people made mistakes, they made up for them later, that anything that happened that was wrong was a misunderstanding, basically, and that you should just make amends and move on. Mm. And I think she's also very determined to tell Cinny a different version of their own childhood story and is delighted when she thinks that the story she sees in the Clemens daughters supports her version of what she wants Cinny to think about their own pretty sad past.
And that's another thing that is so true of families and Thanksgivings. And the more you say something about the past, the more it becomes what's true about the past, even
yes.
if it wasn't.
Yes.
Yeah. We don't want to give away the endings, but there's one heck of a Thanksgiving dinner in which everyone in a circle of friends is invited over. But also there is the father, now completely debilitated in a wheelchair. It sort of comes to a head over the telling of a story of the carving of a turkey. How did they each see that?
Well, Frances tells that story as a charming anecdote of the father making such efforts to carve the turkey perfectly that it takes a very long time and the turkey becomes cold in the process. And Cinny remembers it as a horror story with the father wielding an electric carver he's never used before and destroying the turkey and in a rage throwing it onto the ground and letting the dog eat it. And they both believe that is what happened.
And Cinny's memory when I was reading that, that's a painful story. Everybody's sitting there while Dad gets increasingly rageful and, you know, the turkey ends up on the floor. I mean, when you really think about that, did Frances block out the truth? Did Cinny make it up?
I would imagine that they've tailored that story to their impression of their childhood.
Well, and there comes a moment when Cinny realizes that maybe their two different versions are both true. It's an exchange at the end of the holiday week. It begins with Cinny, who we've been led to believe as the protagonist is the only truth teller. She starts this exchange. I know you have it open there. Would you read it for us?
Our father was a cheater and our mother died, and by the end we all wanted her to. That is not what it was like. Francis looked up at me with dignity, a spoon in one hand. That's not what it was like for me. Then lucky for you. Even before the words were out of my mouth, I knew they were true. Her childhood, spent in the same house with the same parents, had been luckier than mine. It was as basic and as complicated as that. And not because of any real difference in what we'd been given, though Francis had been given more, by my father, by birth order, by genetic happenstance. But what we'd received hadn't, in the end, created the disparity between us. It was simply that Frances had always been able to make more out of what came her way. That was her nature. Lucky for you, I repeated.
Yeah. Which brings us to the thing that we realize is what everything else is about, and we're not going to give it away too much, except to say that, oh yes, we forgot to say that perhaps someone in the family killed their mother decades ago, the mother who was very ill and who died. And as you peel these layers back, you realize why Cindy didn't want to come home for Thanksgiving dinner. There's a lot that could be revealed if you show up for Thanksgiving dinner. There's a lot you might have to talk about.
Well, I think especially because people have such high expectations for Thanksgiving. It's supposed to be the time where your family looks the way you hope they could look to everybody else, because often there are other people who are invited too. And it's so hard to live up to those expectations and old hurts and disappointments and sorrows end up coming through and cracking open what was supposed to be this perfect family occasion. I think families with stories a lot less dramatic than having a possible murder back there, find them equally difficult to navigate.
Especially if you do have a sister who at least seems able to have the perfect household, and you don't. And by the way, Cindy, the sister who's the narrator, the protagonist, she actually isn't either as reliable as we thought she was, or perhaps maybe even the right storyteller.
Well, I think there is no reliable story you can tell about somebody else's life. Mm. Whatever story you tell about someone else is going to be just a version, and it's really going to be more about you than it is about them.
So perhaps the moral of the story for listeners heading for Thanksgiving dinner is that you could be the one that needs to revise your view of your family. It may not be them, it may be you.
Well, I also think that people's ideas of their family should remain dynamic. Maybe that's the healthiest way of dealing with your family, is figuring how you feel about them is going to be different tomorrow, 6 years from now, 20 years from now, and that is the way to live with them.
Yeah. Suzanne Burney, author of The Ghost at the Table. Suzanne, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.